Today's guest on the show is Charlie Kuehr. Charlie is the founder and CEO of With Intelligence. With Intelligence is a leading provider of data on and for the alternative asset management industry. Charlie most recently oversaw an investment in the company from private equity fund Motive Partners for a reported £400 million. We are very excited to get to speak to Charlie today. Hi, this is Hitta Mattel on the Innovators Exchange, and I'm delighted to welcome today Charlie Kuehr, who is the CEO of With Intelligence. Thank you for joining us, Charlie.
Absolute pleasure.
It'll be great just to start with a brief intro to your role in the company that you're at now.
So I've been at the same company for 25 years. It's called With Intelligence. Before that, I hadn't lasted for more than a year in any business, so I was quite surprised that it's been 25 years. In those 25 years, the role has been the same, which is kind of lead the strategy of the business and to help it transform from what it was, a small B2B publisher, into now a data analytics business whose role in life really is to help LPs allocate capital better and GPs raise assets better.
Let's go back and ponder through that story, because it's a pretty awesome story from back in the day. And I guess, as I see it as an outsider, it was felt like a specialist publishing media company. Describe to me at the start what it was like. And I'd love to know also, was it clear where it was heading to back in the days? Like, what was it like when you kind of started out, and what were your views on where were you going?
Well, I think the really lucky thing for us was that Seb, who was my best mate from school, and I, we started when we were 26. So we had nothing to lose, and we had a great opportunity to learn on the job. And when we started, we really didn't have a clue what we were doing. We just knew we wanted to run a business. I'd been in publishing since leaving school, and we knew that the more offshore your customers were and the more financial they were, the more they paid. So we started off doing a magazine called Offshore World, and we would go to places like the Isle of Man, Bermuda, the Bahamas, and they say, we're doing a special report on you as a financial centre and the government supporting, et cetera, et cetera. And that was a great way to get the business going. So you turn up in the Bahamas, you walk away with 40 grand worth of cash, you write a few articles, do some ads, and then distribute the product. And then it was sort of probably 2 or 3 years into that, we realised there wasn't such a thing as offshore finance. So we thought there are various disciplines. So let's try and get a brand that matches each of those disciplines. So we went for hedge funds, we went for something called Captive Insurance. We started a magazine called Captive Review, and I often say the only person that would launch Captive Review would be an idiot, and the only person that could kind of keep it going and make it successful was a great entrepreneur. We've done both of those things. So, you know, 20-odd years on, Captive is still going. But the real genesis of it was being a publishing business that wanted to be more subscription-driven. We had no idea where it was all going. In the first year, it was really about, can we keep this thing going for a year? I often call it girlfriend replacement therapy, because my girlfriend at the time, who has since become my wife, broke up with me. And it was the best way of kind of going through a breakup, starting a business, because you could put all of your effort into that. I don't think we had a clue that it would work out as well as it has done.
Amazing. There's a life lesson for the other young budding entrepreneurs. I'm gonna patronize some of my listeners who may not have even picked up a magazine, right? We're talking 1990s. You're talking, you know, it's print. You got to walk into, shout out my old news agent that I used to work at, or WH Smith. I'm like, how is this getting distributed? Talk to us a little bit, like, in the 90s. Who's picking it up? Where does it come out? Like, this is probably a world for some of the listeners out there that is alien. So it'd be good just to kind of paint the picture for them a bit.
So it was all part of the kind of B2B publishing world, which was very much controlled circulation. So you had an audience who needed to meet an end market. And the way to do that was for somebody like us to create some content for the end market and get the advertisers to reach that end market by subsidizing that. So it was about producing nice content. You would, a typical controlled B2B controlled circulation mag would have maybe 25,000 copies. So quite intensive in terms of printing the stuff, in terms of sending it out. And it was very much an analog thing. And it did very well. So, you know, recruitment advertising was an incredible engine. And, you know, you would be spending, this is back in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, you'd be spending £2.5-3 grand on a half-page advert in something like Computing or Accountancy Age. And that really was the content. There was other content in there, which was, you know, how to become a better accountant. But really what people wanted to do was think, how am I going to get a job? And so that's what they were consuming these things for. But very cost intensive. Content was, as I say, nice to have, but definitely not critical. And you choose an audience and then go off and create content for them and get it subsidized. So that's what we did with Offshore World. And then there were other businesses that were trying to have their cake and eat it. So it was not only are we going to produce this content and get advertising to pay for it, they're also going to try and get the end market to pay for a subscription. And those were very strong businesses, and Euromoney was one of those at the time. So we were trying to morph that, but there was a huge amount of testing and learning, and also just kind of learning how to meet a payroll, to give our customers what we said we were going to give them, etc.
Yeah. And when did things start to change? When did you start to realize, you know, the structure of way that media is consumed, and it was, you know, it was going to start to evolve the business to what you've become now, right, as a data and info services company? When did that inflection begin? What kind of piqued you to kind of start to change the way things were done?
I think there were three or four phases for us. The first one was in 2003 when we got our first non-exec chairman. And he really helped us become a structured B2B publisher. We learned about databases and universes and that sort of stuff. 2008 happened and we thought, oh my goodness, this really is quite scary. We've now got to start really focusing on things. And at that time, we were able to get better quality people into the business and we were able to do things that other people had stopped doing. And then in the early 2000s, we started acquiring a lot of subscription-based stuff, primarily from Euromoney. And in 2016, we took on a guy called Graham Elton, who's just been phenomenal for this business. He, and I think you know him well, he's an incredible man, phenomenal. Very, very thoughtful, not an ounce of ego, very pragmatic. And he really taught us that you've got to create value in the things that you're doing. And in 2017, we bought two more businesses, one called Hedge Fund Intelligence and one called II Searches. And when we bought those, we started getting into the data side of things. And I think that's when the penny really dropped, that if you are trying to get to a customer on a subscription, on a new subscriptions product, you're probably going to end up, you're going to start off at kind of 2K-ish. If you've got a data product that is actually filling critical use cases, it's 10K from the get-go, and then you can build and build and build from there. So I think that's what we've tried to do over the last 5 or 6 years, and I think we've done it successfully, is really improve the quality of data that we collect, the way that we surface it. And I think there are going to be huge opportunities in the next little while to really make sure that you get better quality data and then you interpret that and then you do different things with it that really help your customers make the connections that they need from that data, save them a lot of time, get into their workflow and that sort of thing. So a long-winded answer to your question is, I guess, since we started buying data businesses, we knew that was the future.
Yeah. Hearing you talk, I mean, it's interesting, right? It's a multi-decade journey. It's a non-linear path. And I guess if we bring to where we are now, like the world's kind of mildly obsessed with put the words data, put the word alternatives or private markets, and you kind of, you know, it's like honey with bees flying around it. I guess, give me your take on why is the world so enamored by these things right now? And like, what is the opportunity going forward around, you know, the data space, the alternatives, the private markets?
So I think if you look at the end markets or private markets, there's been a phenomenal amount of growth in those end markets, and I think that will continue. There are slight sort of bumpier times in private equity cap asset raising at the moment, but I think we're all agreed that private markets have got a great future. I think what data allows you to do is really, and the data, to be clear, the data that we're collecting is really around an investor relations use case. So we're collecting data on competitor performance, and we're also collecting data on what the investors are allocating to, often which funds that they're in. So what we can do is not only tell you who the 10,000 people that could potentially invest in your fund are, we're beginning to be able to tell you, actually, these are the 150 that you really should talk to. And if you were on a desert island, take these 20 with you. And that's using data that is both above the line and below the line. And by what I mean above the line is what is generally known about. And below the line is what you will tell us, not want us to publish, but will help with matching. And when you're doing that, you're able to really help an IR focus on the people that they should be talking to and finding, you know, really meaningful relationships at the end of that. And if you look at the way a lot of asset raising is done at the moment, the placement agent industry does phenomenally well. And I don't think the placement agency is going anywhere, but there are lots of things that they do that data and tech should be doing. And there's a huge profit pool to go after that.
Yeah, yeah. Fast forward for me, kind of 3 to 5 years. You know, there's a lot rumbling on at the moment. Impact of AI, resurgence in kind of written content, not just structured data. Like, with your best forecasting specs on, like, what does it look like in 3 to 5 years, this space?
I think it's going to accelerate really quickly. And I think the end market is going to become more regulated. So the data need from that end market is going to be more of a regulated quality as opposed to what I would call an info services quality. So I think the data will get stronger. I also think that what you will be able to do with data, not only through AI, but also by getting better data sets using graph data, etc., I think you are going to be able to really save time from both an allocation perspective and also from a raising perspective. And it's really going to be those that have got not only the sort of organized the best public set of data, but also have ways of enriching that data that other people don't. So I think the world that we're going to be in, hopefully in 2 or 3 years' time, is we're going to own your desktop. So if you're an IR at a hedge fund or a private credit fund, the first thing you're going to do every day is turn on our interface, and you're going to be in all day, and it's going to add a tremendous amount of value to you in terms of knowing which are the customers that you need to speak to, and then sort of building out from there to make sure we can create as much as we can an end-to-end solution for the allocating and the asset raising. I think it's going to be really exciting. You know, in terms of the journey of this business, we should really have done what we've done in the last 25 years. We should have done it in 8 or 10. The first 15, we were just sort of testing and learning in a sort of very amateur way. So I think the partner that we've got now, Motive, are a brilliant partner for us because there is very much a kind of tunnel between their Old Street Innovation Office and our office in London Wall, where we're getting a huge amount of talent. And in doing that, you can really start putting the building blocks of delivering those 3 to 4 years' time.
Sounds exciting. Sounds exciting and a lot to play for. I guess you hit on something really interesting there for me, which was around as more and more things come dependent on this data, that requirement for it to be regulated or viewed as the criticality of the role it's playing. It's almost as critical as like the infrastructure, you know, whether you're an exchange group or whether you're the power grid, like the dependency on these elements. I think that's like a real step change in the maturity of, I guess, how these things are brought and delivered to the market. I think that's going to be a key change. We're starting to see elements of that, but I think you hit on a key point there. I'm going to change tack slightly, Charlie. And if you don't mind me doing so, I'd love you to just elaborate on a little bit of your story coming out of school. You weren't a traditional profile developer. You've told me this story before. I'd love you to, if you're comfortable sharing, kind of what's it like growing up through that period, and what do you think from that period has enabled you to be so successful in terms of where you've got to today? I think it'll inspire a few of the listeners.
Yeah, so I think, you know, I was at school before you diagnosed things like ADHD, et cetera. I'm not sure that, in fact, I'm sure I've got ADHD. I haven't been diagnosed with it. But, you know, when I was at school, I really wanted to be good at something. The one thing I was brilliant at was annoying the teachers. I did that really well. And so my education journey came to an end prematurely when I was 16. I left this really smarty pants school, Stowe. Really enjoyed my time at Stowe. Met some really nice people. Met some of my best friends at Stowe. But, you know, I wasn't going to go on to have an extended academic career there. And so left and then went to work at British Telecom as a 192-100 and 999 operator. So I went from a school of enormous privilege into this room with 99 working class middle-aged women and a 65-year-old called Reg. And it was the best way to finish my education. It's the best way to learn, you know, what it really is like to sort of have to earn a living, have to get to where you should be on time and really kind of knuckle down and conform. And I think for me, it was a lovely way of ending that kind of privileged world to getting into the workforce and sort of learning some lessons early. And I think it's the thing for me was, I think the academic failure made me think, right, I really want to nail this and I really want to build something and be successful. I wasn't entirely sure what successful meant, but I was determined to be it. And, you know, for the first 10 years after leaving school, I was selling advertising in various different places to more responsibility, but always learning about things and always being curious. And I think that when you're building a business and you're an entrepreneur, you've always got to be curious. You've always got to be thinking, if we did that slightly differently, what would that mean? How are we going to... And I think the sort of more neurodiverse you are, the more ways that you see things differently, the more opportunities you create. If you don't need to see things differently, why would you? I think that's the exciting part. And I think what we try and do it with is basically get as many people... create as much of a diverse team as possible and, you know, let it blend and let it thrive. And I think failure is an important thing. I think failure is a really important thing when you're young. The more you fail, the more you understand what failure is. The later you fail, the harder it is. So I think we're always encouraging people to make mistakes in our business and learn from them quickly and just kind of, you know, test and learn.
I love that story. There's so much in there that resonates. Just unpack a little bit what some of those lessons were that you learned in that first job posting as being the operator. Any standouts?
Well, yeah, I was a terrible operator. And every time I got a customer on 192 that I didn't like, I'd give them a spurious phone number. And I get lots of complaints. And then they would come to me and I'd say, oh, Reggie's so naughty, isn't he? That's my 65-year-old colleague, the only other man. I think what I learned there was, I don't know. You're in a world where it's very different to the world of privilege that I think you can get in a education setting. And I think you learn what it's like to be in that environment. And I think, you know, when you are in any business and when you're leading any business, the more you can empathize and communicate with people, the better. And I think it was a really good place for me to learn lots of lessons and really understand what it's like across the spectrum. So I think, you know, I was only there for 8 months and I was paid $4,000 a year for a long time. It was the most financially secure that I was and it was the best 8 months ever.
I think that it's a pretty powerful message, right? I think there is, you know, there's a lot of hullabaloo over some of these esteemed academic institutions. I had a very privileged academic upbringing myself, but when I think about what I do in my day job, some of the most valuable skills and lessons I've learned was growing up in a corner shop. Except it's kind of crazy that everyone's aspiring and out there chasing some of these illustrious names and institutions, and yet we just overlook some of the basics. So thank you for sharing. I think that's a really powerful, powerful story. Talk to me a little bit about what it's like going through some of the capital raises, investment rounds you guys have been through. I don't know, I think you've been through at least a couple. Good to hear your view of what that's like and how it plays through.
We bootstrapped for the first 21, 22 years, and we didn't take on... I think we took a loan on for the first time probably in 2019 for an acquisition. But by the time we got to 2020, when we did the deal with ICG, all the shareholders were the original shareholders. And I think that was important because it meant that we hadn't diluted. And once you do that transaction, you can then sort of take the risks taken off the table, and you can start doing things with more confidence that you would have done before. I think a lot of these processes, and I'm very pleased I've only done two, are a little bit like general elections. You know, for about 6 months before you do it, you start writing your policies, you start talking to DD providers, you create a story, and it is a story. And all of that time, you're not running the business. And then you go into the campaign, and the campaign is when the process actually starts. And then offer day is bid deadline is election day. And then you sort of go into the process of governing again. And I definitely feel that the whole process part is a real distraction from running a business. And I'm hopeful that I won't be doing one of those for a while. I think it's really important to try and get as much as you can from your partner. So motive as I say, we've got this kind of secret tunnel of talent that's coming from them to us. And, you know, you could think, well, do you really want them to be so involved because they might be sort of trying to drive the direction, etc.? I think it's really important to collaborate. And I think the most important thing that we can do as a business is make sure that whatever we do, every day we improve in doing it. And if you are the worst in the world, but you improve every day, at some point you will overtake the person that is brilliant but doesn't improve. And I think it's about taking the talent from places like Motive and other partners, Graham Elton, and just putting that into the product and having the confidence to be learning all the time. And that's, I think, a critical thing, that you're always learning and you're always determined to make sure what you've done this year, you do better next year.
There's a thread here, Charlie, when you tell your stories, which I love, which is that continuous growth, continuous learning, right from when you were mastering how to annoy those teachers when you were 16 through to all of those areas and elements of growing the company. What does it look like now? Like on a personal level, how does it feel when you look back on what you've achieved? It's a pretty amazing story. The company's in an amazing place. The market for where it serves is red hot. Like, what are your reflections when you look back down from the mountain? How do you feel?
So I think we all suffer from imposter syndrome. And I think the interesting thing about imposter syndrome is that what you've got to realize is every other person is suffering from imposter syndrome at the same time. So don't worry about that. And then I think you get to a point, you think, actually, I'm not an imposter anymore because I've done all these things and been through all of these scrapes and these battles. And actually, I feel that there are not many situations that I can't read and understand as a result of all of those battles. So I think it feels really good to have built something that has, you know, on a very selfish level, has been great for me financially, but on a much broader level has been something that, you know, has been a really good platform for lots of people that worked in the business. I love the fact there are lots of marriages and lots of relationships that have been created and lots of careers that have been launched within it. And I think it's great, but what you can never do is think, oh, how clever am I? Because then you're going to get bitten. You can get to the top of the mountain and you think, oh, I'm going to have 5 minutes to enjoy the view. And then you turn around and you see the next mountain. You think, right, I better get up that mountain. And, you know, I'll get up that mountain with more confidence than I did the last one because I've learned. But I'm still going to go up another mountain. Because I think the moment that you're at the top of the mountain and you get too sort of hubristic, things are going to go wrong.
Yeah. Keep growing, it sounds like. Sounds like you keep growing. I'm going to link a couple of threads that we've dropped on. You dropped upon the, you know, the election and raising money, being like running that election process. I guess you, like it or not, you are very successful at creating a British company that succeeded. And we're in the bit of an identity crisis here in the UK about how to do that and create new valuable companies. Like, what's your lessons learned, advice, you know, if you're to a policymaker, if you were in government, what do we need to be doing to kind of, so there's more Charlies, there's more with intelligence. Like, what is it that you think the world's not understanding in that kind of, when they're trying to solve that conundrum?
Do you know what? I think that's a really interesting question because I think the government does a pretty good job at tax breaks that I don't fully understand, but around R&D and that kind of stuff. I think, you know, unfortunately, it's all going to come down to making sure that you've got a pipeline of talent. And I'm not sure that the education system, particularly the further education system, is particularly geared up for delivering that pipeline of talent. And from a British perspective, you know, you've got this massive hullabaloo going on around immigration at the moment. And I think, you know, not enough people make a positive case for immigration. Not enough people say that actually, if you really want to grow your economy and you really want to upskill your economy, immigration is a great thing to do that. And so I think I would be really thinking in government, how can I get a better pipeline of talent into businesses? And, you know, how can I make a positive case for immigration rather than this sort of circular argument that we have at the moment, which is, you know, is we don't like it. We don't like immigration. Immigration is not a great thing. But actually, we're going to double or treble it and upset all our sort of base support. So without wanting to be too controversial, I think people should be making a greater case for that. And then I think a lot of it is to sort of, you know, make sure that there are lots of ways that staff can share in equity. You know, I think that capital gains thing is important because I think the more people that you get involved, when we did our last transaction, I think everybody benefited from the last transaction. But, you know, I think there were over 70 people that were in the management suite. And I think that's really important. I think it's really important that, you know, people in their 20s and 30s can think, you know, I'm a shareholder in this business. And if I do well, they'll do well and vice versa.
I think that's really powerful for me, that last bit. I think how can you create directly or synthetically that equity participation, right? So one of the big things I observe and am passionate about is that there's like an inner entrepreneur and a founder inside of everyone. And if you can unlock it, that productivity and that drive is just completely different if it's just, hey, I'm exchange of labor for kind of a wage.
It's the owner's mentality. You're going back to the shop. It is that, you know, if you've got a direct benefit from what happens in that business, not on your particular job, but in the entire business, you're just going to be that much more committed and wedded to it. And I think that's, you know, I think you want people, that might not be true for everybody, but the people you want to hire are those people that are going to feel, yeah, I own this and I really enjoy winning. And a byproduct of that is financial success. But the real thing that I like doing is winning and succeeding. And if you get those people and you can create the right framework, you're in a really lovely place.
Yeah, it's interesting just listening back, right? Because it's the answers are kind of out there when you look at all those successful small businesses where people are equity participants. But if I look at the talent pool, suppose say we have in consulting or professional services business today, it seems like a lot of the kids face a binary choice. Either go and be an entrepreneur and start your own company, one end of the spectrum, or be salaried and sit in big corporate. But it's harder for them to get that kind of middle ground, which is, okay, I'm going to work for a company, but I'm going to have equity participation. So,
and how can you affect things?
This could be our first policy, Charlie. We should change ourselves into a think tank.
Yeah, I'm not sure that'd be as profitable as consulting or data the alts industry.
Before we wrap, I like to invite guests to talk or share something that they do outside the professional sphere, an interest or a hobby, something that's kind of helped fuel what you've achieved in the day job. Is there any interests or activities that come to mind for you?
I like winding my children up and I like taking them to exciting places. And I sort of think that your duty as a parent really is to help make memories. I take children to Glastonbury every year. I take them to sporting occasions as often as I can. And I think it's, you know, my kids are never going to get a penny, but they are going to have brilliant experiences and you know, the wherewithal to go off and be successful by themselves.
Love it. Love it. And any 2023 highlights that you'd call out on that little?
I went to the World Cup final in Sydney with lots of daughters for the women's football. And that was amazing. You know, having been at the Euro final, which was less amazing, that was amazing. Even though we lost, it was an amazing experience. Glastonbury was really good this year.
Finally, we invite guests to throw the spotlight. And is there an individual or a company, preferably not your own, that's impressing you the most right now that you think is worth the attention of the audience and our listeners?
I think very far away from home, I think what's going on at Microsoft is absolutely fascinating. And I love the idea that this sort of once great business really sort of floundered for a while and under new leadership is doing some really exciting things. And I really like the idea of sort of a second coming and a reinvention in that business. I think in terms of businesses, you know, there are lots of businesses in my space to admire. And I think the businesses I admire the most are people like Wood Mackenzie and Info Services and also Argus Media, who have really made that transition from more B2B world. And I think those companies that have done that, I think, are brilliant. And I think you've got to have a special level of entrepreneurialism in order to do that. And they've done that. Wider than that, you know, it is those sort of big names like Microsoft that I think are fascinating. I think we are going to be in for the most incredible decade. I think it's going to be I'm just reading a book called The Coming Wave, which is written by a guy who founded Deep Mind. I think, you know, the last decade is going to look like an absolute sort of still calm day on a mill pond compared to the waves of stuff that's going to happen in the next one.
Let's brace ourselves.
It'd be exciting.
Indeed. Well, look, Charlie, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been wonderful to walk down the decades and hear from you, winding up the teachers at Stowe to the decade of discovery and trialing and testing the company to kind of where you've got to now. And I think you've got an amazing story to tell. So thank you for sharing it. It's one of the most inspiring ones. I've heard it a couple of times over the years and I never tire of hearing it. I think more people need to hear and be inspired by people like you. So thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate you making the time.
Brilliant.
Thank you, Charlie.
See you later. Take care.